I would like to thank Luca for inviting me here again. I think it was about 2 years ago that you invited me and we had a satsang at the Audeville Library. So it's good to be back. I've been coming here since the year 2000, just for a few days, but I've had that connection with mainly the Samadhi of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. So I would like to give a brief summation of Advaita in daily living. Not as a theory, not as a philosophy, but in daily living. So I was at a retreat 2 days ago and I met this lady about 76 years of age. She was a participant in the retreat. And after the talk, she came up to me and said that she has reached the highest states of consciousness in her meditations. I could not understand the language, but she referred to the seventh state, eighth state, ninth state. But she realized that her daily living was a mess. She had a fight with her closest friend. And for the rest of the day, her mind was going round and round and round. And she was not at peace. And this teaching says, your sadhana, your practice is your daily living, not the practice which is conducted for half an hour in the morning or 1 hour. And that is why even Sri Aurobindo emphasized, meditation takes you inward. But what about work? What about dealing with people? The core of this subject is, are we at peace in our daily living? Are we beacons of peace? Because a great Advaita master said, when he was asked to describe in very simple terms, what is this talk about the self, enlightenment, and so on? And he said, the state of equanimity is the state of bliss. That's it. So I'd like to take you through very briefly what is Advaita, which literally translates as not two. It doesn't mean one. It means not two. So we all are here in the realm of duality. This is the realm of duality of every conceivable kind. Up, down, front, back, left, right, black, white. And then we go into the finer points, rich and poor, pleasure and pain, me and the other. This is the realm of duality we have all, you could say, incarnated into. This is the design of life. Sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain. Or rather, sometimes pleasure, many times pain. We cannot have a life of only pleasure, 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 pleasure. Life is not designed that way. Now this structure, this basic structure we can't get out of, what has happened is that the me and the other has become me versus the other. The basic design was me and the other as the two polarities. But it became me versus the other. It became a conflict. This is the core of the teaching. How do we heal back from me versus the other to me and the other? Because one misperception happened along the way, and that was the ego with its sense of doership. If we accept everyone in our life, especially the people we don't like or the people we don't get along with, if we accept one simple fact, they were conditioned by the same God who conditioned us. We don't know what happened in their childhood. We don't know how their parents treated them, what their life experiences were. What we do know is that they take their decisions based on their conditioning, like we do. So we are born in a certain geographical area, certain economic strata, certain religion, and we get shaped by this conditioning from childhood, all of us. So when we actually have a point of view, we don't realize it's really not our point of view. It is a point of view based on our conditioning since day one. Now, when we realize that the person we don't like, the person we don't get along with in life, the person who is pushing our buttons the most, when we realize that they are conditioned by the same source or force which conditioned us, there is a shift in our relationship. We may still not agree to their point of view. We may have our point of view. But this opposition, this conflict, that how dare you say this? My view is the right view. That drops away from the equation. You hear another person out. You can clearly see that this person is reaching his or her obvious conclusions based on their nature and their conditioning. In this case, I don't agree with it. And I have my point of view. So as my teacher would say, the sting of personal doership is removed from this equation. The hate and condemnation and judgment fall away. You see, there was an American mystic healer who was probably at the highest level of healing. He passed away in the 60s. And his entire teaching was one sentence. Give up the belief in two powers. All there is one source. So anything you meet in life, whether it is a person or an event in your life, is coming from that one source. There is no power apart from God. That is what he would say. Doesn't mean you have to love everyone. But all it asks is accept people for who they are, the way God created them, instead of wanting them to be a certain way. This sentence, give up the belief in two powers, was the tenet of his healing practice. And it was pure Advaita. This we find very hard to do in daily living. Any pain we face in life can only come from the same source, not a power apart from it. So the first step is to accept this. Our problem is we are in conflict and denial of the painful parts of life, as if someone else is doing them to us. So when our worldview is no longer through the eyes of duality, which see the dual nature of everything, but through the eye of singularity, the eye of Shiva, which has understood this game, which is nothing but a chess game of figures in black and white, not making their own moves, but being moved by a higher power. And more importantly, when I live this understanding that at the end of the game, both black and white go into the same box. When I live that understanding, I'm living a life of peace. When I live the understanding that everyone is playing out their blueprint, the way it has been designed. My teacher would say, as an example, a miser, someone who doesn't like to spend money even though he has it, does not choose to be a miser, though it appears that way. We don't know his life experience. Maybe he didn't have money when he was young, so he holds on to it. There are many reasons. But this judgment we make on people, that this person is a miser, I don't like him, he doesn't put his hand in his pocket, that drama which goes on in our mind gets cut off. And when this thinking mind, which is actually the devil which takes away from the present moment, this thinking mind, which creates stories and dramas about people, how they are, how they should be, how I think they should be, because I think I know the best. But I don't realize that I too am shaped by my own conditioning, which makes me see things a certain way, which may not be the truth. When I have this humble acceptance that the way I see things is my way, I don't force others to see it this way. When I have this acceptance, I find, by and large, my relationships become harmonious. Because I have no fight with anyone now. And as my teacher would say, this is the point when you can agree to disagree with someone without being disagreeable. You can agree to disagree. I don't share your point of view. Let's agree that we don't share our points of view. So we have a problem with this. And what this living teaching of Advaita says is, move on. These are just points of view in this game of life. But what we do is, not only are we not at peace, we take away other people's peace of mind. We feel we have the right to destroy someone else's God-given gift, which is peace of mind. That is what we indulge in, a subtle form of violence. That is why Goldsmith would say that if you have this understanding that everyone is shaped by not only childhood conditioning, but prenatal conditioning, what was going on in the mother's mind when the baby was in the womb. I have someone who comes to the talks who gets suicidal thoughts, but she is not clinically suicidal. And then it was revealed in therapy that her mother used to have suicidal thoughts. You see, it is a bombardment of conditioning from day one. That is what has happened. I gave this example. It was funny at the time, but it explains it beautifully. I was at the club one day. I had two friends with me. Both were in the advertising profession, on the creative side. Next table, girl in a beautiful green dress. Beautiful. So one friend said, "What a beautiful green dress." And the other friend said, "Yes, it is beautiful, but it's yellow." And so the one who said it was a green dress said, "I think you're blind, it's green." And the one said, "You're blind, it's yellow." And this went on and on. So I said, "Look, as long as we agree it's a beautiful dress, does it really matter that much that you've destroyed this whole tea conversation by going on and on about it?" But that is what we do. We will force our point of view down people's throats. And this teaching says you cannot do that. My teacher put it in a different way. He said, what happens when we pronounce judgment on someone? You are right or you are wrong. What we don't realize is this person in front of us is an object in our eyes. That is the first step. So we pronounce judgment on the object. And we forget, we think we are the subject. So we have the right to pronounce judgment. We forget that we are also an object in the other person's eyes. So it is actually one object judging another object, when the subject is God. And he referred to this as the original sin, that an object thinks it is acting God and like God and condemning people, hating people, ridiculing people, criticizing people. How do you know? Perhaps your conditioning was the most flawed. So the next time that same person who makes you cry or hurts you says something, you might just look at the person and wonder, this person is playing out their script. You can see actually the force which moves through them when they are doing what they are doing, and realize that what they are saying in the moment is nothing but an output of their years and years of conditioning, their innate nature, which is making them say that. And then compassion may arise. Where there was an immediate reactivity, compassion may arise. My God, this person might actually be suffering their conditioning. You see, this is what happens. Our vision, which is split with the eyes of duality, gets healed. And then, as Goldsmith says, if I have this understanding with everyone I meet in life, then my relationship is no longer with people. My relationship is with God, because God created everyone. I am no longer seeing them as separate compartments of views and opinions. I am seeing the one behind the many. Some I like, some I don't. I'm entitled to my preferences. This teaching doesn't say hug everyone. You are made a certain way. Honor that way. But do accept everyone. That is the difference. That is why my teacher's last words, when he was asked, Someone who, as Luca would know, used the most highest words in Advaita. Noumenon, phenomenon, absence of the absence, absence of the presence. He could go into it deep. His last words were, love each and everyone in your life, each and everyone, as if you created them. And Goldsmith echoed the same words. He said, it's too easy for us to pray for people we love. But we know the man of understanding will first pray for his enemies, because he knows that they too are an instrument of God. It's too easy to pray for our loved ones. What is the point? I have a Sufi guide in Kashmir. He's about 78 years old now. And he told me their biggest day in the year is Eid, where they celebrate with their family and children, grandchildren. He said one day he told his children as a realization, he said, look, you have each other. You don't need me anymore. You have your children, you have your brothers, sisters, celebrate Eid. And he walked out of the door and said, I'm coming back after 2 days. He came back, they asked him, where did you go? He said, I went to the orphanage where people don't have parents. And I told them, I am your father today. And I celebrated Eid with them. This is called living Advaita, walking the talk. That is why the lineage which I come from emphasized daily living as the sadhana, because there are enough scriptures to read, philosophy classes to attend, understand all those, that has their place. But the translation into daily living does not happen, because it is everyone's experience and wish that on the day they leave this body, they'd rather leave in peace than in conflict. It is everyone's experience that the deepest peace they have felt in their lives is when they are asleep. The peace of deep sleep. Everyone's experience. Which means everyone's experience is absence of conflict is the deepest peace there is. As simple as that. There's nothing more to it really. It's quite simple, this teaching. God is kind enough that 1/3 of my life, which is the deep sleep state, He has given me that peace. That is how generous God is. And that deep sleep is the absence of me as an individual. That is why it is deep. Because I'm absent in deep sleep, there is peace. But I come in the waking state, then the trouble begins. That is why I saw this one cartoon. I think it was Snoopy or something. Just one box is all that is required. He says, I was doing okay and then I woke up. That summarizes this whole thing. So this burden that we carry on our shoulders day in and day out. He did this to me. She said that to me. How dare he? How dare she? I won't look at this person. I won't talk to that person. And I start cutting people out of my lives one by one. And then I have a life of duality. Only those I love are there. I'm polarized. You see, the pendulum, if it is held at one end, is going to swing to the other. Any identification which is polarized in the realm of duality is going to meet its opposite. That is the nature of life. Which means, if you love someone, you already hate someone. But the pendulum which does not swing, which is at the still point in the center, is not identified with the polarized ends. It is flexible. There is no one to truly love, no one to truly hate, if all there is consciousness. I fully understand in my own kitchen, I have various gadgets. I have the fridge, I have the microwave, I have the juicer, I have the toaster. These are gadgets designed a certain way. And when electricity runs through them, they produce what they are designed to produce. A toaster is going to produce toast. A fridge is going to keep the food cool. So why can I not accept that the same consciousness functions through everyone and brings about that which that person is designed to bring about? I don't expect the toaster to cool the food. I know the toaster is designed to be a toaster. But I have this expectation with people that although they are designed a certain way, I want them another way. I want them another way. What right do I have? Who has given me this right to want people to be another way? People are the way they are, the way God has made them. But I think I know better than God. And so this is the essence of Advaita, that the consciousness right now, which is speaking through me, is hearing through you. It appears in the realm of duality. There's me and you. But consciousness is speaking. Consciousness is listening. Because if you were not conscious and I was not conscious right now, we would both be dead bodies. So who is speaking and who is listening? When we meet people in our life, in our day, this understanding that the same consciousness functions through everyone is gone. Because now we are seeing individuals and we've stuck labels on their foreheads. But that essence of who we are, which is the same, is pushed into the background. And this teaching says, bring it up front. Honor people where they are standing. Accept them the way they are. It is not saying to love everyone. It's not possible. It's just saying, allow them to be who they are. Listen to them. Don't stop them mid-sentence. Let them express themselves. That's all it is asking for. And you will find by and by, life becomes so simple because your mind is not full of garbage anymore. In simple ways, very simple ways. Like I gave the example of one movie, a Hollywood movie which had come out. And one friend over dinner said, what a fantastic movie, amazing. And the other friend said, really, I thought it was rubbish. So the first friend said, you have no taste in movies. Same thing as with the dress. This, why can't we accept that one person loved the movie and the other person didn't like it? Why is this happening all the time in our lives? There's nobody who says both of y'all have to like the same movie. So why inflict your judgment on the other person because he didn't like the movie you liked? But we are so used to the action-reaction loop in life. How arguments happen, then we are trying to see that we win the argument, we have the final word, and our mind starts going into horizontal time, imaginary future or dead past. Our mind is constantly in horizontal time. When this thinking mind, which is full of all these concepts, quietens down, by and by, each day I meet, each person I meet, reminds me of the truth. I find my mind is really becoming awakened of dialogue. Then I am in the moment as pure being, not as been, not as becoming. I'm just there as pure being. I meet being. I don't see a person when I meet them. First, I meet my own essence. Then I see the person has certain traits, characteristics, shaped by their destiny, their blueprint. The other thing is, the Maya is so strong, the illusion is so strong, that it appears things are apart from us. It appears I am apart from you, because this is the realm of duality, subject-object. But the fact is, I am an appearance in your consciousness. Can I appear outside your consciousness? Even if you close your eyes and listen to my voice, that voice is arising in your own consciousness. So can I be any closer to you? The voice of your enemy and the voice of your friend are arising in your own consciousness. There is nothing apart from you. But it appears that way. There is nothing that you see, hear, taste, smell, or touch that is arising out of your consciousness, outside your consciousness. It is inside. It is so intimate. Therefore, what is the content of your consciousness? Is it one of separation, hatred, malice, jealousy, envy, pride, arrogance, guilt, shame? Is that the content of consciousness? Or the acceptance that in the final analysis, the only doer is God, because He has made all of us. Then by and by, I lead my life. I have a particular point of view, maybe political, maybe anything. I do what I have to do. But the sting in the equation with individuals is pulled out. And I wish the person peace at the end of the day. My mother had a spiritual master who was a high court judge, a judge of the high court. And he used to sometimes try cases of crime. And sometimes he had to pass the death sentence. And after passing a death sentence, he would get up from his chair, go to the criminal, give him a hug, and come back ready for the next case. My teacher's teacher was prone to anger. He was not calm, equanimous. He had a short fuse. So one day, someone asked him a question. And he told the man, "What a stupid question you're asking. You've been sitting here for 3 weeks and you're asking such a stupid question." And the man replied, "What can I do, sir? God made me stupid." And he burst out laughing. You see, the sage will not hold on to this anger like we do. The anger arises naturally, biologically, and then we stretch it in the duration of time and make a story out of it. I should now not talk to this person. I'm angry with this person. For the sage, anger may arise. I have met Vedic astrologers who say some horoscopes, the position of planets, shows they are prone to anger. They are fiery. The planet Mars is located in a certain house. It will be their nature. So what is a biological reaction? The average human being stretches it in the duration of time, and then that anger in the moment becomes prolonged anger, which becomes toxic. Toxic for myself and toxic for the other. Because the ego takes ownership of the anger. I am angry. Whereas the sage knows anger has arisen. There is a famous example given in spirituality that a man is on his boat in the middle of the lake and falls asleep, and suddenly there's a thump. Some boat has crashed into him, and immediately he screams. And then he sees there was no one in the other boat. And then he doesn't know what to do. Because there's no doer now. There's no individual who banged into me. I am now, what do I do? It happens so often. I have been asked about road rage. People say, "Oh, we understand everything, but on the road we lose all these concepts. One car comes like this and then we start hurling abuses." Why is that? I'll tell you, because when someone does something like cut into my lane or a little bit hit me, he has done it to me. And my car is the extension of my body. I own this car. I paid money for it. This is mine. How dare you come in my way and bang my car? The ego got so identified with the object, which is the car, and now it is threatened because someone banged into it. My sense of self is now threatened, and so I abuse. But when we see it as a happening, all right, let's park our cars on the side of the road, discuss what has happened. That does not happen. Something so simple as an incident could have been handled another way. And it happened to me in Bombay once. I was in a taxi, and we were going towards a signal, and another taxi gently hit this taxi. So one taxi driver told the other, "What were you doing?" in a loud voice. He said, "I was watching the birds. That's not the point. What were you doing?" You see, what is the attitude to life? What is the approach? This teaching shows you that true happiness, not happiness, happiness depends on pleasures, and pleasures come and go. Our own life's experience is happiness is transient, here today, gone tomorrow. True happiness is our attitude to what happens in life. And our attitude to what happens in life depends on our attitude to the other, whoever it may be. Could be a stranger on the road, could be a beggar, could be my colleague at work, my parent, my child. In my agency, I had hired a senior group in charge. And one day I heard him shouting and screaming at the staff. He was new and I was not used to this kind of an approach. I kept quiet. I said, perhaps everyone has their ways. Till a staff member came crying, saying that I can't take this anymore. Not only screaming and shouting, but he kicks our chair, which we are sitting on. So I called him and I said, what's going on? He said, what do you mean? I said, is this the way to work and get work done? He said, I'm really sorry. I have no idea what you mean. I said, are you getting work done by threatening and shouting at your staff? And he said, what other way is there? So I said, what do you mean? What are you trying to say? He said, in my previous company, that is how my boss treated us and got the work out of us. So I'm doing the same thing. Do I blame him? I told him, there's another way. Don't lose your humanity in your relationships with people. This one person in the group does not have the capacity. How can you force it? If the person is not performing, ask him to leave. It is like in my school, I remember, one very nice, gentle boy, when we were in the 6th standard or 7th, was made to stand up on the table and recite, I am a failure, I am a failure, I am a failure, by the teacher. With no understanding that not everyone is designed to be bright in studies. God has made them that way. And then this child is identified with the word failure all of its life. So this healing vision to not see individuals responsible in the sense that they have made their own genetics, nature, conditioning, and so on and so forth, but there's a higher power, a higher force which is behind this all, which makes people say and do certain things. And that is when Goldsmith says, I decide to lay down my sword. I decide to withdraw opposition. It's very simple. You are playing a tennis match. In daily living, it's an argument, hitting the ball back to the other. It only takes one person with the understanding to put the racket down. Both don't need it. One person needs it. All right, there's no point in arguing beyond a point. I don't have to win all arguments. Why do I have to win all arguments? Why must I always be right? This is Advaita in daily living. So simple. My teacher would say it's so simple that you don't get it. Or as one famous, I don't know if it was a Greek philosopher said, the truth is simple. If it was complicated, then everyone would get it. And what is this simplicity? It's even this is simple. What is the truth? It's a very big word. What is the truth? Supposing you went to a new country and introduced yourself to a stranger, you could use any name. Hi, I'm Peter John. He'd believe you. It may not be the truth. Your given name is something else. What is that truth which nobody can deny? What is that truth which cannot be refuted? And he gave a simple example. Supposing right now, God pushed a button and all your memory was wiped out. You don't even remember your name, your family, your friends, the work. You do nothing. Entire memory is wiped out. What remains? What remains is pure being. I know I exist. I'm not dead. I still know I exist. I don't know as what I exist. I exist. That is the truth. No one can deny their existence. Everything else can be denied. Some may agree with it, some may not. This, what he referred to as the impersonal awareness of being, because there's no person here. When my memory is wiped out, it is impersonal. But there is an awareness of being, is in everyone. The baby had it. The baby didn't have an ego. It got created later. Pure being. Why do we love looking at babies going to babies? There's that purity, pure consciousness, unstained by the ego that has been subject to life and conditioning. That pure being is here right now in and as everyone. It didn't go anywhere. It got covered by the veil of duality, doership, and a ego which got encrusted with layers and layers and layers of conditioning. But the being is still there. Someone who came to the talks tried this, developed his own exercise. He said, now when I see people, I think of them as the pure baby they must have been. Beautiful. It's a fact. The person you don't like was that pure baby at one time. That pureness has not gone because the person is still alive. So we find by and by our vision is now resting in peace through our day, through our life, because we are resting in being. That is why the most banal and boring description of the purpose of life is the most accurate. The purpose of life is the living of it, not a goal somewhere in the future. Enlightenment, self-realization, living it here and now. I don't have to wait till I die to rest in peace, to be written on my tombstone. What kind of a life would that be? If I can find, finally, that I go to bed today, I think this might be my last night on earth. And I am able to say, thank you, God, for all the people you brought into my life, not just the ones I loved, the ones who taught me life's greatest lessons. Thank you for bringing them into my life. I would not have seen aspects of what was within me if that had not happened. If my final prayer is a thank you for all that has happened, then I know I will have a good night's sleep. Because you may not wake up tomorrow. It is assumed you will. I had a client who had a lot of anger. My staff could not deal with him. They would all say, we are not handling his account. He's a very angry man. He knew it. After 5 minutes, he would call them and apologize. I'm so sorry, I couldn't control my anger. He was a nice chap, but he had a short fuse. One day he called me. He was very upset. He said, I lost my anger on my uncle in the night, my mother's brother. I really lost my anger on him. I couldn't sleep all night. So the next morning, I called to apologize. And he had had a heart attack in the night. And he said, I cannot apologize now to him. Now what do I do? Anger still arises. So he said, now I have figured out a way. Next time I meet someone, I first apologize for my anger, then I get angry. It's fine. It's so hard to change our patterns, you see, but you find a way through it. But look at what it took. You assumed that person would be there the next morning to apologize to. Who gave you the luxury of that assumption? And what is the degree of awareness, more importantly? There's a famous story in our scriptures of this boy who was tortured by his father, Prahlada. And he sailed through everything without uttering a word. And the Lord was so impressed with this boy, came and stood before him and said, I grant you a boon. Ask for what you want. He said, I don't want anything. You've given me whatever you gave me, I have accepted gladly. No, I insist. I insist you ask for a boon because what you have displayed is very rare. So the boy thought about it. He said, all right, this is what I want. I want that you should do no harm to those who have harmed me." The Lord was shocked. "People have harmed you, and the boon I'm granting you is that the Lord should do no harm to them. What kind of a boon have you asked for?" And he said, "No, Lord, because I know to wish harm upon them is to wish harm upon you, because you created them. But harm is something which we really want to do all the time. If not to people, then to the environment, to animals. And animals are closer to God. Why? Because they don't have the sense of doership that humans have. Animals don't go into the dead past or an imaginary future. That is why the same Sufi mystic I mentioned in my talk 2 days ago, he has a line outside his shop. People come to him for advice, for getting healed of their ailments. That's what he does all day. And I told him, once we went to the mosque and we were feeding the birds, which he loved to do, and all the beggars came up and stood in line, not for money, to salute him, Badshah, Badshah. And I was so moved, and I thought, I told him, I said, "This is amazing." He said, "No, no, nothing is amazing. These people have got something for me, whether they've been healed or whatever it is, money. That's why they are coming and shaking my hands. When I die, I don't know which of these people will come for my funeral, but one thing I know." And he told me, "Please come so you can see it yourself. That when I die, my coffin, when it's being taken from my house to the burial place, all the birds I have fed for the last 20 years will be flying above. They know what loyalty is. They know what gratitude is. They know what love is, not human beings." So that's it. I think I've tried to say as much in this time, and I apologize if it's not been a deep talk, but there is truly, in my personal understanding, the only most precious gift, which is peace, mine and the others. That is the highest teaching. So thank you for coming, everyone. Thank you.